Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're happy to have in our studio here Dr. Lena Nguyen, Baltimore City's health commissioner, the youngest health commissioner in the United States. She's been doing some really interesting and remarkable things since she got here. We already have a tweet and an email with questions for her. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner as we talk with Dr. Nguyen. And welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Very glad to join you. I've heard you so often and am really delighted to be here in your studios today.
Thank you. It's good to meet you. So let me take a step backwards for a moment, because you're new to the city, relatively speaking. And people, there have been some articles, but everybody doesn't read The Sun, everybody doesn't read The Atlantic Monthly. And so just talk a bit about you. I mean, you were born in China and grew up in L.A. Talk a bit about you that way as a child and where you came from.
Sure. I think that where I came from plays a big role in what I'm doing now and why I'm in Baltimore and the work that we're doing now, too. I grew up in some very difficult areas in Los Angeles, in Compton and East L.A. I grew up with all the issues that we have surrounding us. My classmates were the victims, but also the perpetrators of gun violence. My family often didn't know whether we could meet the next paycheck and the rent check, and we often did not have a stable place to live. I was surrounded by individuals who had addictions, including members of my family as well. It was those experiences that motivated me to go into emergency medicine, and specifically working in the ER, because I never wanted to turn any patient away because they couldn't pay for their health care. But it was also in the ER that I saw the limitations of the work that we do, that we can patch up the gunshot wounds, we can treat someone with naloxone to wake them up from an overdose, but that we did not have the tools we needed in order to refer people into treatment and to get at the underlying issues. Because it's never just violence that somebody is a perpetrator for. There's also deep trauma. There's also systemic poverty and huge disparities that we have to address. And that's why I'm here in Baltimore, to work on these larger issues and to take care of our city.
I mean, so you actually began as a clinician, as an active working physician, but something drove you into public health. I mean, you wanted to address these issues from a larger policy point of view, from changing systems.
It's in the ER that I saw what we can do for the individual patient in front of us, but we're addressing the acute issue. We're putting Band-Aids on problems that actually go so much deeper. And that's a big part of the work that we do here, that we realize we can't just see someone as that perpetrator of violence without also addressing the trauma that they may have had. People living here in our communities often experience the type of trauma that you experience in a war zone. There are huge undiagnosed and untreated mental illness concerns. There are also huge issues with addiction here in our city. And so working in the ER made me recognize what some of those issues might be and the work that we have to do, not only for the patient in front of us, but getting at the deeper roots of those problems.
So, sometimes the work of a health commissioner can be at odds with, can flow with, but also be at odds with, the criminal justice system. I was thinking of the speech that President Obama gave yesterday to the International Association of Police Chiefs in Chicago. And he got a round of applause for certain things he said. But when he said that he supported the idea that we should be not jailing as many people as we do, and many of the police chiefs kind of responded negatively by saying that when he was suggesting we should not be locking up everyone who's addicted to heroin and other drugs, that there are other ways of addressing this, but we see this as a way of social control and controlling what's happening around us, the police do. So, and that's been a question here in Baltimore forever, where the majority of people who are in prison, a huge number of people in prison, have mental illness, are drug addicted, have all those kinds of issues to be addressed. So what about the conversations about alternative ways of kind of addressing what is, to me, one of the underlying social issues? Poverty is the underlying social issue, and racism, but I mean, what fuels it is our arrest because of drugs.
You're absolutely right. When we look at our data, we know that 8 out of 10 people in our jails here in the city use illegal substances, and 4 out of 10 have a diagnosed mental illness. We are criminalizing individuals who actually have diseases. This is not just my saying it. This is science. This is evidence. These are facts that individuals are being put into jail for their diseases. We have to recognize that addiction is a disease, just like high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, and that it's our job to treat that disease, not only because it's our moral obligation to do so, but also because it's actually what's better for society. If we're treating addiction, if we're treating mental illness, then we are helping to reduce the poverty rate. We're increasing employment. We're reducing crime. That has also been shown through science and data as well. To your point about police, we work in the Baltimore City Health Department. We work very closely with our police department on issues like overdose. We have been so our new police commissioner, Commissioner Davis, was the when he was the chief, the police chief in Anne Arundel County, he was the first police chief in Maryland to do naloxone training for police officers. And in the last month, since we have been training police officers and since our patrol officers have been carrying naloxone, there have already been three lives that our officers have saved, which I think is remarkable. But that's the type of work that must be done in collaboration, because we're all doing the same thing. Public health and public safety, public welfare, it's all the same thing. It's just that we intervene at different places. We are intervening at the beginning and saying, let's prevent crime from happening in the first place. Let's interrupt the violence. Let's stop people from getting addicted. That's the work that we have to do.
So I'm going to probe this for a bit more. I mean, so let's talk about the naloxone. That was an interesting campaign. There was some opposition to it, but not as furious as I thought it might be. But talk about that, what you did and the idea the police are carrying naloxone, how they administer it. And so talk a bit about that whole philosophy and policy.
Absolutely. Let me go back a little bit and explain what naloxone is. So there are compounds, drugs called opioids. Heroin is a type of opioid. So are Percocet, Oxycodone, Oxycontin, these prescription painkillers. How they work is they work on the brain to stop someone from breathing. Initially, that person gets a high, a feeling of a high, but then they stop breathing. And within minutes, within less than 5 minutes, that person's brain cells will shut down, their heart will stop pumping, and they will die. There is one antidote medication called naloxone, also known as Narcan, that is safe, it's effective, it's really easy to use. As an ER doctor, I've used it on hundreds of patients and have seen how someone who would otherwise die will be walking and talking again within minutes, which is really remarkable to see someone who is totally unresponsive be going about their normal life again and be able to be revived. We believe that naloxone should be available everywhere to everyone. In the same way that we have defibrillators available, if somebody is having a heart attack, we all should have the ability to save that person's life.
All of us?
All of us. Every single person. And what we have done is we have advocated for change in the state law that went into effect on October 1st, such that I am now able to prescribe naloxone to every single person, every resident in Baltimore City, as long as people go through a brief training. And naloxone can be given either through the nose by a spray or is injected into the muscle. As long as someone goes through that training, then they can go to any pharmacy in the city and they can get this prescription. Hmm. It's remarkable that we can now do this in large scale.
So the officers actually doing it via needle, or are they doing it? I mean, how are they being trained to do it?
They are currently being trained. Our police officers are currently being trained how to do this through a nasal spray.
Right, right, right.
But there is also a intramuscular injection through the muscle of the thigh or the arm. Same thing as an EpiPen that's used if somebody is having an anaphylactic reaction from peanut butter. So we're training two sets of people. We are training the first responders, which includes the police officers, because often they are first on the scene or they might come across someone who is unresponsive. And we're also training family and friends and anyone in the city who might come into contact with someone who is overdosing, which in a city with 19,000 people who use heroin, in a city where we have more people dying from overdose than are dying from homicide, all of us could see someone who is overdosing, and all of us can save a life.
So what about the men and women who are working on safe streets, which comes under public health? Many of the former felons who are working the streets to address the violence in communities, are they also being trained?
Great question. We have just trained our Safe Streets employees. They are frontline workers as well.
They're on the streets every day, every night.
Absolutely. And we are so proud of our Safe Streets program. We hire individuals who are known to the community, who are going back to the communities that they serve. And they do such difficult work. I mean, these are people who only have their words and their reputation, their credibility. They're working with other individuals who have weapons and who have committed violent crimes. And what they're doing is to mediate conflicts and to talk about nonviolent conflict mediation. And so we're proud of the work that they do, and adding one more tool in their toolkit for saving lives. Normally they use their words and save lives for violence. And now this is one more tool to save someone's life from overdose.
I'm going to come back to Safe Streets, but we have folks do join us here, 410-319-8888. We have a tweet and email that are pretty similar. So let me kind of pull this up as the email, because it's a little bit longer than a tweet. It's from B. Moore Dock, who is a public health professor here at Morgan State University, Lawrence Brown, who writes in, why hasn't Commissioner Wynn ever stated, quote, police brutality and race-based trauma are threats to the public health of Black Baltimore residents, end quote. By not making that statement, the health department has missed a huge opportunity to address how racism is affecting our health now.
Be More Doc, I would like to be on the record for saying that. I have already been on the record multiple times for saying that any type of brutality and violence is a public health issue. Mayor Rawlings Blake and I were just at a press conference with our federal partners from the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Justice, where we announced a $1.5 million investment into Baltimore for working on violence as a public health issue. And I addressed then, and I will say on the record now as well, that there are many problems that have gotten us to where we are as a city here in Baltimore that are no different than other cities, that there are systemic racism, there is structural poverty that have gotten us to where we are, where we have huge disparities by race, where we live in a city where 1 in 3 African Americans live in food deserts compared to 1 in 12 whites, where African Americans are 62% of the population, but 85% of those living with HIV. There are huge disparities that are brought on by our policies of mass incarceration, of systemic racism, of poverty. And those are the issues that we have to address. Now, everything cannot be done overnight, but I do believe that using a public health approach is the way to do it, because public health is about prevention. It's about identifying problems using data and then using evidence-based strategies to prevent and to treat these issues. And so I believe we are making quite significant progress in the city, although there is a lot more work to do. And I look forward to working with Be More Doc and others.
So that'd be interesting. So just for a moment, just to take that tactical, come right back to the issues of poverty in our community and the stuff that you're trying to get done here, and do want to come back to Safe Streets. Part of the spirit of his question, I think, was that the racist past and present of Baltimore, being the city that in 1911 created legalized housing segregation, that all the other issues that people face, the documented and undocumented, true and untrue accusations against major institutions that have experimented on mostly Black young people, lead poisoning and more that people feel, which is one of the reasons that people do not sometimes answer the door with health workers, because they don't want to be part of an experiment that was said, that actually was said. So how do you address that directly? How do you make that part of the conversation, A, to change the way people understand why we are the way we are, and to address the issues that we face?
You know, let me go back a little bit and explain where I come from as well, from my other part of my professional background. Until recently, I was the director of patient-centered care research at George Washington University in D.C. Mm-hmm. And the concern that I faced all the time as a patient advocate, I was a patient advocate and caregiver for my mother for 8 years while she suffered cancer and unfortunately died from her cancer a few years ago. But I saw what happens when we don't really listen to our patients. When our patients feel like we're doing what's good for us, and by us, I mean by the hospital or by administrators or by doctors, and we're looking at patients almost as a checkbox of, oh, I've talked to the patient, I know what the patient wants. That is not patient-centered care, and that is certainly not engaging our community and the people that we serve in the right way. And applying that to the work that we do now, we fully recognize that we cannot, as the health department or any government agency, come to our community and say, this is what you need. I mean, that's the last thing that our community wants, is for us to impose from the top down things that we think are the priorities. So our strategy is completely different. We hold community meetings. We hold biweekly town halls. We have our outreach workers. We have over 1,000 people working in the health department, most of whom, the vast majority of whom, are from the communities that they're serving. And we ask them, what are the issues that you're seeing? What are the issues that we should be working on? And allowing us to then identify long-term issues, knowing that something like addiction cannot be solved overnight. But then we also hear people say, look, if you can't help us solve addiction, okay, let's work towards it. Let's increase treatment slots. Let's work on stigma. But in the meantime, let's stop people dying. We've heard from so many people here in our community about how their cousin, their niece, their uncle, people that they know are dying from overdoses. So that's why we're targeting that as our short-term goal on the way to these long-term solutions that we know we have to do. We do not see community participation or engagement as a checkbox at all. In fact, what we do, our number one principle in the health department, other than serving those who are the most vulnerable, is going to where people are. We don't want them. Not, we don't need for people to come to where we are and say, well, come to our fancy hospitals and do the work that we need to do. No, we have needle exchange vans in our communities. These are trusted outreach workers, and our community knows that we're not there to arrest you or judge you for your drug use. We are here to help you prevent diseases. We are here to save your lives. We're here to get you into treatment. That's the mentality that we have, and that is why we are effective in getting our messages out. Can we be more effective? Absolutely. But that's the strategy that we're taking to do so.
So, folks, do join us here at 410-319-8888. We have Dr. Nguyen with us, Lena Nguyen, of course, is the Baltimore City Health Commissioner. 410-319-8888 is the number. We want you to join us with your calls and your questions for her, or email us, as we just read, at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. What I found really interesting, your response to the aftermath of the death of Freddie Gray in our community. And you saw it very much as a public health issue, and your response as public health commissioner, I think many people may not be aware of, when the CVS burned down, the other things that you did, how you responded to that, and your thoughts about who Freddie Gray was. I think that's important. We hope to have you on numerous times over the coming year, but just introducing you to the community, because many people just don't even know who you are, how you think, and what your perspective is around public health. But let's start with this Freddie Gray question.
Well, let me tell you about how we thought about our response in the wake of what happened in April. Our initial concern was the safety of hospitals. That is our role in the mayor's emergency operations center, that our role is to, along with the fire department, police department, help to keep our hospital safe so that patients have a place to go if they're ill. But then we began hearing about another concern that we would not have imagined that we would be dealing with, which is that at least 13 of our pharmacies were burned down or looted or closed in some way. And initially, people thought, well, what's the big deal? Why can't you just go to another CVS or Walgreens? Well, that may not be a big deal to someone who is able-bodied with a car, with family nearby. But imagine if you're 75 years old, in a wheelchair, dependent on oxygen, and you're watching the news and it looks like the world is burning down outside. How are you supposed to drive and go or walk 3 more blocks and go to different stores? If you have a car, or you don't know if it's even safe to walk outside. And we begin hearing from people in our community who ran out of their insulin, ran out of their blood thinners, and were literally dying because they didn't have access to medications. So we set up in the health department a 24/7 prescription access line. We said, we will figure it out for you. You call us, and regardless of whether you have a question, you need your prescription transferred, you need them delivered to you, we will figure out how that will be done. We also found out that it wasn't just a question of prescriptions, that unfortunately many of our residents live in food deserts and they were dependent on their local grocery store or corner store for food. And people ran out of their insurance, they ran out of their supplies, they ran out of just basic needs. And we worked with our state partners to help set up shuttles in senior buildings and with our local faith leaders to get out the word to churches and to into their community. So I think that's an example of the type of belief that we have, that it cannot be from us saying, this is what I think you need. Rather, we need to respond to the needs as identified by our community. We have to respond swiftly. We have to take immediate action. But we also have to make sure that we're reaching the right audiences. It can't just be my tweeting this in social media, but we have to be reaching the individuals who are the leaders in our communities, such as our faith leaders and neighborhood associations and so forth. That's the way that we'll be. That's the way that we handle other health issues as well, but I think this was a particularly acute one and one that many people saw.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I'm going to stop you.
And similarly, we also heard from our community that one issue that came up after the unrest in particular, but also that is an underlying issue, is the one of mental health, that many of our residents are traumatized on an everyday basis, and there needs to be an outlet for people to talk about trauma. And that we need to recognize that individuals are victims and not just perpetrators of trauma. And so we set up a mental health and trauma recovery plan with a 24/7 access line for any mental health or addiction concern. We also have implemented trauma-informed care trainings throughout the city so that we are now training our city workers, our frontline city workers, whether they're teachers or police officers or healthcare workers or homeless outreach workers, on identifying, understanding, and treating the effects of trauma. Those are all things that we have worked on because of what we have heard from our residents about ongoing needs. And so that's, I think, our lessons from the unrest and what we're planning to do about it.
We got a tweet from David, who tweeted in, how does public health adjust violence when our culture worships violence in sports and media?
It's a really good question, and one that we wrestle with a lot. And I suspect that all the questions that we get are going to be difficult to answer because there are so many components of it. Violence, we believe, is a public health issue. Because just like something else, like measles or the flu, it can result in death. Certainly in working in the ER, I've seen violence resulting in death many times. There's also a cycle of violence that occurs where trauma then leads to violence, that leads to trauma, that leads to violence, and individuals who are perpetrators of violence often are the victims of violence as well. Then there's the issue of where we can intervene in that violence, that I see our role in the emergency department as anytime somebody comes to the ER, there's an opportunity to intervene. We actually just launched a campaign called Words Not Weapons to encourage ER doctors and providers to address this issue. But then we have the prevention issue, too, and I think that's mm-hmm. the one that our listener is commenting on, that there are many ways for us to prevent violence from happening. There is, we have to work through our media, through our celebrities to get there, but that prevention also needs to begin with employment. It needs to begin with education. It needs to begin with early childhood opportunity. One intervention that we know is very effective in dealing with violence is home visiting for pregnant moms. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because we want to be able to identify domestic violence. Your previous caller, your previous guest was talking about domestic violence. We need to be able to help to identify domestic violence. We have to help to teach a culture of nonviolence. And we have to help moms and families raise children in the healthiest and best way possible.
So there's so much here, and I just one more another couple of questions here about this whole the focus we're on at the moment. I was thinking as you were speaking about the people in this program have talked often about the criminalization of poverty in our communities. By that I mean, you know, we've seen ten cities taken down. I've visited a lot of the shelters that are in the city. Most people don't want to live in those shelters because a lot of them are not well run. They're very tough places to be. And people would rather be actually sometimes living in the street than they would inside of a shelter. We had the story here the other day of a woman in a town hall that we did at UMBC and told the story of a woman who was homeless, living in an abandoned house. And so she was arrested for living in that abandoned house and convicted of fourth-degree burglary. And she was put on probation. She had nowhere else to go. She had no idea what else to do. She was on her own. She went back to the very same place to go to sleep. Was arrested again, given 2 years in prison for fourth-degree burglary on a public property. So any of that, to me, people kind of classify in a broader sense as a criminalization of poverty. So, I mean, as health commissioner, you can't change the laws. You can't deal with every question of how we deal with things in terms of criminal justice. But what is that dialogue taking place to change? What's your role in changing our public policy when it comes to issues like that that are pretty fundamental to uplifting people who are mired in poverty in this city?
The story that you told about this woman is so unfortunate and so depressing, but very unfortunately, it is all too common.
Yeah.
I hear this from my patients in the ER all the time. And these are not bad people. These are good people who unfortunately do have many decades likely of trauma, many decades of problems of poverty and facing huge disparities. I've learned in working with my patients who are homeless, experiencing homelessness, that there are so many stories that they will tell that are almost unbelievable, except that they are true. And we need to do a much better job, not only with our individuals who are homeless, but also especially with addressing mental health and addiction issues. And that's why this is one of the key priority areas for us in the health department. To your question about what it is that we can do, you know, I'll say that a big part of the work that we do is explaining why public health is important in these conversations and making sure that we are part of them. If we go to a community meeting and I say that I'm the health commissioner of the city, I begin hearing about rats and bed bugs,
right,
and often about what happens in a hospital because people think of that as the health care that they get. But if we think that even someone who is relatively ill, who goes to see their doctor, let's say once a month for an hour at a time, mm-hmm, the vast majority of their time, 365 days a year, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day are going to be spent somewhere else, whether it's at home or at school or at work. And those are the other factors that will make them healthy or unhealthy. And we then have to explain that to our community about what that means for their health and why they have to value the environment and why they have to value these other things as part of their health. But then we also have to assert ourselves in public discourse, in conversations with our elected officials, in conversations also with our other agency heads and leaders throughout the city. For example, in education, to me, it's common sense why health and education are very much linked, that if a child has terrible dental pain, they can't be focusing on their schoolwork. If they don't have glasses, they're not going to be able to learn. And so that's a conversation that we always have to have, that we need to be addressing health and education together. The same thing when it comes to issues related to criminal justice, that we have, for example, we were able to advocate for the passage of the Good Samaritan law in Maryland, such that if you see someone who is overdosing and you call 911, that you will not be arrested. And that is critical because we need to be able to save lives. And so that's part of the work that we're doing to, even though this might be seen as a criminal justice issue of whether to arrest someone for a drug offense, for us, it's about saving lives. And that is the message that we have to push every single day.
So I have a question to follow up with that, but let me go to the phone. People are calling and also tweeting in. So let me get a tweet here and a couple of callers are coming in at 410-319-8888. So a concerned father tweeted in, Naloxone won't stop heroin use.
Well, we get this question a lot, so I'm very glad that that we are getting this question now. Our philosophy is that if we do not save a life today, there is no chance that this individual who is using heroin or using other substances will have any hope for tomorrow. Tomorrow they might decide, or even today they might decide, to go into a treatment program. We know that what helps people recover from addiction is a combination of medication-assisted treatment and psychosocial support and physical and treatment for their other physical ailments. But if this person has minutes to live, if we do not save their life right now, there is no chance that they'll get into treatment later. Of course, I agree that we need far more than naloxone. Naloxone is at the very end stage of someone's life. We also ideally will have prevented everyone from starting drugs in the first place. But even before that, we should get people into treatment before they're overdosing and literally dying. That is something that we're working on as well. I would love to see treatment on demand at the time that someone needs it here in Baltimore City. It's unconscionable to me that in the ER, and I've experienced this many times as the provider, that someone will come in saying they want detox, they want services that day. But I tell them, I'm sorry, I can't get you in for weeks or months. We would never tell someone that if they're dying of a heart attack. We would never say, come back in 3 weeks and let me see if you're dead, if you're dead at that point.
Right.
And so that's the work that we have to do. But at the same time, I want to remind our listeners that naloxone is not addictive, number one. Number two, it actually takes away someone's high. And so there is no chance that someone is going to be using drugs to get naloxone, because nobody uses drugs in order to lose their high. Number three, naloxone does not have any side effects on someone who is not using heroin or opioids. So it is completely safe and easy to use. And number four, that there is always this question that we have to address. Some people will say, well, isn't this just going to make people use drugs more if we have this, if we have naloxone available?
Right.
Well, you know what? We will never say to someone who has a peanut allergy, well, just now that you have an EpiPen, now you're going to be eating peanuts all the time. We would never say that. And so there is an element of stigma that is behind us thinking that giving naloxone to someone will somehow increase drug use.
Let me go to the phones here, 410-319-8888. And we talked to Dr. Lena Nguyen, our new city health commissioner. Line one, Michael, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, Michael
Hi,
Scott.
Dr.
How are you?
I'm great. I'm Michael Scott from Equity Matters. And so I just want to first commend the commissioner and also invite her into further work that she's already on the trajectory of in this health department. You know, we're really thrilled with her direction and her vision. Maryland, I think, and Baltimore heretofore has been really challenged with understanding what the Global Commission on Social Determinants at the World Health Organization and what APHA, especially under their latest leadership that Tamara Jones has called for, which is the real intentional strengthening of civil society, right? I mean, policymakers are not the only ones that change policy. It's civil society, and that sort of also ran really strengthening those institutions. And we've been doing that work at Equity Matters and Place Matters in 27 cities and counties. And I think we have, 27 cities and counties, and I think we have a real opportunity to continue that. And I would invite Dr. Nguyen to comment on, you know, her thinking about how we can intentionally strengthen both civil society, one, and B, as we think about these really important frames of social determinants like economic violence, you know, causation and correlation to physical violence, how we get at bringing to Baltimore what we've seen work in other cities, which is anti-racism organizing and language at the governmental level. We just had a training with the Civil Rights and Wage Enforcement Office with a number of agencies, and it seems to be something that across the board folks think we need, and public health has always played a critical role in tackling that most difficult of social determinants. So I want to commend her and also get her comments to further support the great trajectory she's on.
Dr. Nguyen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Scott. It's always a delight to hear from you. You and Equity Matters have been terrific partners for us over the years, and I commend you for bringing up the critical issue of social determinants of health. I want to spend one moment on this because I think that this is something that we often say, but that we often don't pinpoint exactly what that means. And what it means is that we cannot just talk about healthcare as it happens in a hospital. We have to talk about all the other components that lead to good or bad health, including employment and whether somebody has a job, including socioeconomic status, including where someone is born. We know that here in Baltimore City, that there are neighborhoods that are just blocks apart where the average life expectancy is 20 years different. That depending on whether you are black or white and depending on what the zip code that you got born in and got raised in, that will determine how long you live. And that is not the kind of society that we should be or that any of us want to be living in. And it's those social determinants that also lead to health or to lack of health. And it's something that you have done great work on. And so I applaud you for that. To your question about the involvement of civil society, I absolutely agree. Having come from the nonprofit world, having come from academia and advocacy organizations, I've spent my entire career up until this point outside of government. And so I completely agree with you that this needs to be a collaboration. That there are things that can be done through government, but that everything that we do ultimately has to come back to the communities that we serve and the people on the ground who are working with the communities, who are identifying the needs of the community. What we can do through the government are we can provide direct clinical services as we do. We can help set policy, but again, with the input of our community, and we can provide evidence. And so we can get the health data about our city. What are the problems that are happening and how our interventions are going? So I absolutely agree that that's something that we should continue to do. And I appreciate your support to get there. To your question about more work that needs to be done in government itself, again, I completely agree, which is the reason why we have trauma-informed care trainings that are beginning. This is the start of our work to make sure that we are seeing individuals, our residents, as people who have experienced many issues themselves over time. I mean, I mentioned my own background earlier. Certainly, there are deep scars that are left from my upbringing, and I would say that for everyone that we have met in our community, that there are many deep issues that must be addressed, both personal issues that we have faced, but also systemic problems that have resulted from a culture and policies of racism and poverty. And so I very much look forward to working with our partners to addressing these critical issues.
A couple of things before, and one more call before I get in here. Kenneth, let's get to you, then I have a couple more questions before I know Dr. Nguyen has to run. 410-319-8888. Kenneth in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Thank you, ma'am. Appreciate your work. You have literally hit the ground running, and a lot of politicians need to get behind you and hit the ground running right beside you. As for drugs, a person has to be absolutely sure they want to get off. We have to convince drug-addicted people that they have to get off from drugs, or they have to convince themselves. When they do get off of drugs, we have to have the treatment programs ready. No red tape. I believe in recovery houses. The Catholic charities are very good at that. They give drug addicts a place to sleep, a place to grow, clothes, food, a job. And after 2 years of being there, you can come out saving a lot of money and make a new start. The other thing is, as a pregnancy, young women are pregnant that have children at a young age. They need to learn how to be mothers. We need to teach our young mothers how to be mothers because they're just kids themselves. You understand?
All right, Kenneth, let me let the health commissioner respond.
Kenneth, let me address your second point first, if I may, which is you brought up a point that I forgot earlier, which is that we need to be talking about the successes of our public health programs here in the city as well. And one of the issues you brought up is around our pregnant women. And we, back in 2009, Baltimore had the fourth worst infant mortality in the country. We were on par with other countries that were in the middle of war. I mean, it is unacceptable that our most vulnerable, our babies, were dying. As a result of bringing together over 100 partners, both civil society partners, nonprofits, as well as government agencies, the Be More for Healthy Babies campaign has since reduced infant mortality to the lowest rate it's ever been. We have halved our number of sleep-related infant deaths. Hmm. Now, there's a lot more work that still has to be done because even one infant dying, one child dying is unacceptable. But I think we have to talk about the work that has been done and why it's successful. It's this collective impact strategy that works with all of us working together on a single goal. But also, it is home visiting, the home visiting services that we offer to first-time teen moms, that we offer to our most vulnerable moms, that and about teaching the ABCs of safe sleep alone, on your back, in a crib, no exceptions, about stopping smoking during pregnancy. Those are the messages that work. And Kenneth, you also mentioned the treatment on demand and addiction as a disease. I completely agree that we cannot be telling someone that they should be waiting days or weeks to get the treatment that they need. If somebody has overdosed and decided that that is the day that they want to get treatment, or even if somebody has not overdosed, but somebody said, okay, this is the day that I want to get treatment, I'm ready to quit. Addiction is a disease. It's so difficult to reprogram your brain so that you are ready to quit. I mean, getting that person to that point is so critical, and we have to get that person the treatment that they need. We already have a 24/7 access line that I mentioned. You can visit our website at don'tdie.org for further information about our about our treatments and about getting training for using the overdose antidote naloxone. And we certainly encourage everyone to participate.
So I know we're almost out of time. I know you have to run to another place here. And there are so many things to talk about. We'll have to get you back very soon to do that.
I love that.
And I know that something just came out that you are pushing for legislation that would ban the sale of synthetic drugs like K2 or spice and bath salt that young people are using to catch a legal buzz. So talk a bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've seen patients come into the ER for they're intoxicated, they're hallucinating, they're psychotic, and they tell us afterwards that they used what they thought were safe alternatives to illegal drugs, but they're actually not safe at all. These are synthetic drugs. They're known as spice or K2 or bath salts, as you mentioned. They go according to all kinds of other names. So what they are chemical compounds that are made in a lab that are then sprayed onto dried plants. And corner stores and gas stations then sell them, marketing often as they are quote-unquote natural. They are not natural. They're the opposite of natural. They're made in a lab. And they're also not safe at all. I've seen patients get heart attacks, have liver failure, kidney failure from these drugs. It's basically rolling the dice. You don't know what you're going to get at the end of the line. Maybe you get a high, but sometimes you die. And we want to raise awareness about this. And so we have started a public education campaign to people, so to youth and to parents, about the danger of this drug. We have also informed our retailers. This week we sent out nearly 2,000 letters to our retailers to say, you may not know that you're selling this drug that's actually going to kill people. And so please help us and put up a sign on your window that says, not a drug dealer. And for all of you listeners, if you see a store that's selling these synthetic drugs, call us at 311. And report that store, and we will be investigating. We're also introducing legislation in city council that our mayor has supported to ban the sales of these drugs so that there is a fine and the possibility of closing down the store as well if it does sell these dangerous substances.
So I know you're running out. There's a car waiting for outside. You got the next thing to go to. But I just want to say one thing about safe streets real fast. I'll let you out of here. When I first heard that some people were arrested inside of Safe Streets, a program that I have supported and been behind even before it got here in Baltimore, as I think our way of dealing with violence and many other issues in our poorest communities, and really giving men and women coming out of prison a reason to live and a reason to work and do service to their communities, which I think is vitally important. When that happened, you could have chosen to run the other way and say, we have to shut this down. But your response was the opposite. You expanded Safe Streets.
That's right. That's right. We feel strongly that the safe streets model works. This is, again, not just my saying it, but it is based on evidence. Last year, our safe streets employees mediated 880 conflicts. 80% of those conflicts were deemed to be likely or very likely to result in gun violence. Now, how do we even quantify the number of lives saved, the number of injuries prevented, and what that does in our community to instill that sense of peace and that sense of engagement in the community as well? As you said, Mark, we hire individuals in Safe Streets who are often recently returned citizens who just came back from jail or prison. We believe in giving people a second chance. Not only that, but we also know that these individuals are the most credible messengers. I can go all I want to the streets of West Baltimore and talk about nonviolent conflict mediation. People probably laugh at me. They might not really see me as a credible messenger. But but someone that they know who is a leader in the community, who is back in the community that they serve, they are the most credible messengers. We embrace them. We see them as the true unsung heroes who do great work every day. Now, I'm a physician. I prescribe medications to people. I recommend, I do procedures that are needed. I always explain to my patients that there is a benefit and there is a risk. One of the risks of hiring individuals who are recently returned citizens who are getting paid minimally, by the way, and working in very dangerous environments is that it is possible that some of them could be implicated in crimes, which, of course, we do not condone criminal activity in any way. But we recognize that that is a risk that we take, but the benefits far outweigh the risk in terms of what these incredibly committed individuals bring to not only the health department, but to our city in terms of making our city a healthier place. And so we're very happy to be expanding Safe Streets now, thanks to a federal grant and also to a grant from the ABLE Foundation to a fifth site that is going to be in the Sandtown area. And we are looking forward to strengthening our protocols. We have already, after the incident in Safe Streets East, strengthened our security protocols, strengthened our background checks. We're working with a broader array of community partners. We have done a full debriefing of our staff and retraining of our staff, but we are fully committed to expanding Safe Streets and to strengthening this into a model for violence prevention for our city. If I may add one more thing, that I would love for our listeners to see. I hope you'll see the passion that I and my team bring into our work, because we really believe that public health helps to level the playing field of inequality, that there are disparities, health disparities and others, that bend the arc of justice. And it is our role to use public health as a social justice tool, to do the right thing so that we can not only make people healthier and enable us to be a stronger city, but so that we can be a more just and equitable place as well.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, our City Health Commissioner, thank you so much for joining us today. Look forward to having you back very soon.
Thank you, Mark.
Take care. We're going to take a very brief break. Come back. It's time for What's Happening in the City paper this week. Don't go away.